Thanks for tuning in to WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, co-host of Studio 2, and this is a Studio 2 Extra.
I was young and I left home, and I've been out rambling around.
The new movie, A Complete Unknown, chronicles Bob Dylan's life from his arrival on the New York folk scene in 1961 until his famous 1965 concert at the Newport Folk Festival, often framed as the moment Dylan broke away from said folk scene. Shortly before this film came out, Bob Dylan posted a message about it on X. He praised Timothy Chalamet, the actor playing him. He also noted that the movie is inspired by a 2015 book called Dylan Goes Electric, and he urged everyone to read the book, which he called fantastic. Now, this came as quite a surprise to the book's author, Philadelphian Elijah Wald, who was not exactly expecting an endorsement.
That was completely out of the blue, completely astonishing. I mean, the last word I'd heard was when I early on had asked whether they had given Dylan a copy of the book, and they said, Bob doesn't read Dylan books. So that was sort of where I thought we were. And so I had no expectation of that. And I mean, it was thrilling. It was great.
At the very beginning of the book, you acknowledge up front, you've never, at least when you wrote the book, you'd never met Dylan.
No, I've never met Dylan. And I quite honestly, when I started working on the book, I called the Dylan office and said I was working on this book. I don't need to talk to Dylan. And that was the right thing to say. They were immensely helpful once we'd got that out of the way.
So that was strategic.
Yeah, also, I mean, if there's one thing Dylan never needs to be interviewed about again, it's Newport 1965.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm trying to understand better your reaction to Bob Dylan saying, I loved this book about me. Everyone should go read it. You had no idea he'd ever been given a copy. You've never met the man. You've spent a lot of time digging into his past and trying to understand.
Well, I mean, more than that, you know, I grew up listening to Bob Dylan, playing Bob Dylan songs. I mean, the book is the least of it in a way. No, I mean, it's completely crazy.
Yeah.
And thrilling and pleasant and, yeah.
It also struck me as odd, and I saw the tweet before I even knew I was going to talk to you. And the tweet struck me as odd as soon as I saw it, because I thought, wait a second, this is a very normal, nice, almost predictable thing to say about a movie and a book that's about you. And I thought Bob Dylan's whole thing was constantly knocking you off balance and keeping you guessing.
Yeah, but there's an example.
Yeah, you would never expect him to say this.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's interesting. A bunch of people reacted of, that doesn't sound like Dylan. And a bunch of other people reacted as, you haven't been reading his tweets. That's in fact how his tweets sound.
He's earnest now, I guess.
He has always been a shapeshifter. I mean, we all know that. And one of the shapes is normal.
Why write this book? We're going back many years now, because the book's been out for quite some time.
Look, the simple answer to that one was money. I normally write books that are not going to sell huge numbers. And I make my living as a writer. In 1964, early in the year, the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in the U.S. happened. Well, shake it up, baby. Shake it up, baby. I'd written a book called How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll. It wasn't really a Beatles book, but a few people who had run out of other ideas started calling me, trying to get another angle for that moment. And I thought, you know, 50th anniversaries, huh, that's a big deal. Is there one coming up that I might think about? And I thought, hey, Dylan at Newport, the 50th is coming up. It's been written about a lot. There's no single book on that. I can pull one together in 6 months. I'll own that moment.
6 months? This was 6 months, because it's pretty meticulous.
My original thought had been, this is going to be easy because it's been so much written about. As with all such things, once I actually started looking at it, everything looked different than I expected. And yeah, it was the most intense 6 months of work I've ever put in my life.
I wanted to ask you about watching this project morph into a movie and I actually didn't realize that you've kind of been through this process already before, right?
He was a friend of mine.
So you wrote with Dave Van Ronk, who's sort of the great dean of the Greenwich Village folk scene. You wrote a memoir with him, right, about his life?
It's worse than that. I was trying to write, me and Dave had been trying to sell a memoir that I would co-write with him for 10 years. And he had written a few sample bits to try to market that. And the money just never came in that would have let him get off the road and sit down with me and do that project. And then he died. So I had to write that memoir in his voice. I mean, I used... I called in every interview I could find. So it mostly is really his voice, but I did all the connective tissue. I had to write the book. Yeah.
And that, I don't want to say became an inspiration for the Coen brothers' film Inside Llewyn Davis. Is that right?
Yeah.
Your friend is out back.
My friend?
Said he was a friend of yours. Guy in a suit.
Oh, it's fair.
So, I have been incredibly lucky. I do not write the kind of books that get turned into Hollywood movies, and I've had two of them.
Yeah, I don't know if you could say that anymore. You do write those. I mean, you've written two of those.
Apparently,
books.
Yeah, right.
So was watching this book turn into a complete unknown, was it a different process than the Inside Llewyn Davis process? Like, as far as just watching it from the sidelines.
I mean, from my own experience, it was different because... the Coen brothers, for whatever reason, maybe because of who they were or maybe because they were making an openly fictitious film, I was invited to go, to go on the set. I didn't, but I did spend an afternoon with them in the editing room, which was fun. I'm a fan. This project, I was not involved in any way between when it got optioned and when I saw it in the screening room.
Is that by choice or that?
No, they did not contact me, and that was fine. You know, that's expected. I mean, a project like this, nobody wants the historian to be sitting there. You know, they were inventing all these scenes, mm-hmm. and the last thing they needed was me sitting next to them saying, no, that's not how that happened. No, that's not how that happened.
So when you saw the film... You're like me. You're just sitting down watching it. You have no idea of the guts of it, what went into it. You just sit down in the theater and watch it. Is that what happened?
Absolutely. I had no idea what I was walking into. I mean, I had seen the preview trailer that was on YouTube. So I knew that Timothy Chalamet could sing this stuff. But that's all I knew going in.
So what was your impression walking out of the theater?
I liked it. I mean, you know, bottom line, it was 2 hours, 20 minutes long, and it felt like an hour and a half. I should say one other thing, which was I expected to be annoyed by all sorts of things. And
really?
As a result, I was astonished while watching through it at all the stuff they got right, all the little details they got right.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. The scene where Dylan and Pete Seeger are with the blues guy played by Big Bill Morganfield, Muddy Waters' son. There's a moment where Dylan and Morganfield start playing together, and I was all ready for Pete to be shut out of that moment, for Ed Norton as Pete Seeger. And instead, he picked up a banjo and played exactly the kind of blues licks that Pete Seeger used to play when he jammed on a blues. And it was like, oh, good, they got that right. There were a lot of moments like that, just little things. You know, with the moment when Pete's getting angry at Newport, that Toshi is the one who shuts him down, his wife.
His wife, yeah. Was there anything about the film that surprised you?
Yeah, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know,
was there anything that was...
Something else that really astonished me about the film was that I have since my youth played a song by Dylan that only Dave Van Ronk ever recorded. If I had to do it all over again, I'd do it all over you. I've been playing that forever, and I would have bet anything that that one wouldn't be in the film. And by God, he sings a snatch of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like I say, I was surprised by how much they got right.
Because you expected it to be like a really serious interpretation, I'll say, like a loose interpretation.
No, I mean, it is a loose interpretation, but the period details that matter to me, you know, like there are guys who they watch, and it is guys, no women, who watch things like this and are bothered by the car, by seeing a car drive by that's wrong. I don't care about the cars, but, you know, I'm from that folk world.
The music.
There are lots of things about it, and I knew a lot of these people. So there are lots of things about it that I expected to have a lot of moments like that, and I had very few. I have to say, the film does not have a lot of incidents in it that are taken from my book. What they took from my book was the essential idea that this was the story of Dylan and Seeger.
Yeah.
Which is not how the Dylan story is normally told, for good reasons. They weren't actually in the same rooms an awful lot. That's something the film invented.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Nice
great to see you.
How you doing? We made around the world in 80 days, huh?
It's a magic carpet ride. Just full of wonder. Full of wonder.
I use that as a device because Pete Seeger was the one-man personification of the entire folk scene. And I thought it worked better as a story if you felt a person, not just this idea of all these different people. But I took Pete Seeger because he fit in. He all of those different strains of the folk scene came together in Pete Seeger.
That's better. It's a red man. You sing a red song for it now. But I won't be worried.
One thing you get from the movie is that Dylan, before he got into the folk scene, was clearly interested in rock and roll. They foreshadow that in the movie. But one thing I didn't really understand until I read your book is that by the time Dylan kind of makes it in the folk world, he's already kind of pissed off some other people in the folk world who don't like the fact that he's writing more topical songs and not doing the traditional songs. Do I have that right? I didn't quite get that from the movie, but that's what I got from the book.
Look, the movie has made lots of choices. Mostly, I'm cheerful about the choices. There are a couple of choices I'm a little less cheerful about. One of them is the idea that Dylan came into New York as a songwriter and that other people stood in his way and tried to prevent him from doing his own songs. And that's just not true. He was from a world where you might write a few of your own songs, but that was just part of being a folk singer.
Yeah,
I mean, Woody Guthrie did not mostly sing Woody Guthrie songs. The idea that Woody Guthrie was mostly a songwriter was not how he thought of himself, and that wasn't how Dylan thought of himself. I mean, the one thing in the film that really annoyed me was using the term covers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment where he says, I don't want to do covers. Nobody called singing folk songs covers. Covers is an insulting term that nobody used for folk music until the 1980s. It's an openly insulting term. Dylan wouldn't call singing Barbara Allen a cover right now because Dylan respects that stuff. It's an insulting term. And he didn't feel that way about those songs. And he doesn't now. I mean, that's one of the interesting things, that the narrative that what Dylan cares about is his songwriting and that the rest of it doesn't matter. Nobody believes that anymore because Dylan has by now shown his dedication to the tradition over and over and over. But when people started writing about Dylan, there's this funny narrative that shifts. I mean, I talk about that in the book, that Dylan, when he got signed by Columbia Records, made his first album, was written up in the New York Times, was written up as an exciting singer, guitarist, and harmonica player with this whole new personal take on blues and folk music. Had nothing to do with writing.
Yeah.
Your mother said.
And then Albert Grossman comes on the scene, already managing Peter, Paul, and Mary, takes over Dylan's career, and reinvents Bob Dylan as this guy. He's not a great singer, he's not a great guitar player, but he writes these gorgeous songs that people like Peter, Paul, and Mary can take to the top of the charts.
And there's a business play there for Grossman, right? Because,
absolutely.
Because now he can mass market these songs with, say, Peter, Paul, and Mary as the face of it or the voice of it, and he has a financial interest in those songs blowing up.
Exactly.
All right, before I let you go, you've written this book. It's been, you know, adapted into this huge movie. You know Bob Dylan's read the book. You've still never met him. Would you want to meet him?
The short answer to that one is, I was surprised that Bob Dylan had read this book. I assume he's read my book on Robert Johnson. That's the sort of thing he's really interested in. If I ever met Dylan, I assume it would be because I wrote a book on Robert Johnson and that we'd be talking about pre-war blues.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees.
That was Philadelphia's Elijah Wald, a musician and author of Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and The Night That Split the 60s. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered this podcast episode. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arens, and thank you so much for joining me.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.